Hello and welcome to The Thought Experiment. I'm Scott Berger, and I'm here to guide you through a series of hypothetical journeys through physics, mathematics, and philosophy. So starting off with some announcements, next week we're going to have our beloved co-host Andrew back on. For those new to the show, The Thought Experiment is a continuation from the previous podcast, the Thought-Provoking Discussion podcast, which broke the top 100 natural science podcasts. And Andrew had been our reigning witty co-host, who had been joining us on Skypecast rungs, among other things, to which he's taken a short leave of absence. But he will be returning for next week's show, and he'll be staying throughout, so no worries. Our best buddy will be coming back very soon. This week's thought experiment deals with a 400-year-old experiment that you can perform at home, in which I'll give you directions to do so in just a minute here. An experiment done by Isaac Newton himself, the co-founder of calculus, and also the founder of the gravitational constant and most of modern physics that we deal with in the classroom today. So a very influential fellow, and you can do one of his very own experiments here at home. And what we're going to do is we're going to show how space, meaning the universe, everything around us, everything that you can move around in, is infinite. And all you need is some very simple tools. What you're going to need first is a bucket, obviously. You're going to need to fill the bucket about halfway with water. It doesn't matter what kind of water, preferably fresh water, would be the easiest to get a hold of. You're going to need a strong rope, preferably something thin, not like boating line or something that would tie a Titanic trawler to a dock, and you're going to need something fixed that the bucket can hang underneath. Now, you're going to need some kind of bar or something just about at eye level height so that you can see down into the bucket, and also so it's not a safety hazard to people walking by. You're going to need something strong, so preferably something rigid, and something you can wrap the rope around and secure the rope to using any assorted knots, and you can secure the bucket beneath, so that way you can spin the bucket and watch the whole thing take place. Now once you have those, fill up half of the bucket with water, and secure the rope around and tie the bucket so it's hanging beneath the thing that it's being suspended from. We'll say an I-beam or whatever happens to be near you at the time. The experiment, performing it itself, is a rather easy endeavor compared to other experiments, and it has a deep philosophical meaning behind it. It also has a lot of history behind it, too. And when you're doing this experiment, remember that you're conducting the exact same experiment that the co-founder of a lot of the math that people grow up to hate and a lot of the physics that people don't understand, you're performing the experiment 400 years after of the same man who had helped develop those things. It's a boon to somebody, but I find interest in it, but that's stupid. Once the apparatus is set up, what you should do is you should spin the bucket around, hanging from the I-beam, of course, spin it around such that the line becomes twisted. Now, you want to keep spinning the bucket until the line gets twisted enough such that it won't twist anymore. I recommend using pretty new or line that isn't raggedy or under a lot of stress that could easily snap. We just recommend using safety goggles just in case, and also wearing hard toe boots in case you drop the bucket on your feet, which can happen pretty frequently. Spin the bucket as far as it'll go until the line can't twist anymore without you putting a lot of force into it. You don't want to have to push too hard in order to get this thing moving. Now once it's set up, all you got to do is just let go. The bucket will continue spinning and spinning and spinning, and then eventually it'll stop spinning in one direction and start spinning in the other direction once the line starts getting rotated around the other way. Now what should you be looking for while doing this experiment? You can add another ingredient, and I actually didn't try this because I didn't want to stay in my particular bucket, but you can use food coloring. I don't know which kinds, because they do have a potential of leaving a coloration on the inside of the bucket. If you're using just some industrial bucket that you don't really care about, you can go ahead and food color the crap out of it. And it also helps you to see what you're going to be looking for a lot better. But what should form is what's called a meniscus of the water. And it'll form once the bucket begins spinning in the opposite direction. A meniscus is pretty much a concave kind of dent in the water's surface. Once it starts spinning, it'll make this sort of indent, kind of like the nose cone of an airplane kind of deal. Well, that's all well and good, but how on earth can a spinning bucket possibly show that the universe is infinite? How can an experiment 400 years old, with no need for particle accelerators, with no need for space centers or big rockets to send people out into the universe, how can this simple apparatus that you can do at home show that the universe expands in all directions infinitely? Well, first, let's start off with a little history of space. Don't fright at the name. The word history can actually be exciting when it's applied to awesome things like space. Now, the ancient Greeks, way back in the hundreds of years, centuries before the dawn of Christ era, used to believe that space was finite, but pretty far away, and the geocentrism had been prevailing for a long time. So we've just defined a few words there that we should rather elaborate on. Now, what they meant by space being finite was that when you go out on a starry night and you lie down in a field and you look up, you see kind of a dome of stars around you. Now, this is all well and good, but we know that the stars aren't equidistant away. The ancient Greeks didn't have the technology we have today in order to determine that. So they figured all the little dots, all the little points in the sky were equidistant and lied what was called the celestial dome. And this was way out there. The planets and the sun moved on crystal spheres on the inside and all a bunch of other stuff that we can get into way later. Geocentrism is a long word with a lot of syllables that pretty much means that people believing the Earth is at the center of the universe, which it isn't, which we know today, but the ancient Greeks didn't know that back then. Far, far after, in Newton's time, the 1600s, heliocentrism had been pretty much firmly established at this point, physics showing that the stars are very far away and almost infinite, not necessarily totally infinite, because they couldn't exactly prove it at the time, but anywhere you were to point a telescope up into the sky, you were seeing stars everywhere. Everywhere stars. And determining the distance to them was very, very hard. So the mathematics used to find the distance to the stars, A, was a lot more complicated, B, a lot more recent, and C, a little bit more reliable than the Greeks had chosen. Also, D was a lot more logical. One of the staunchest critics of Newton's experiment was René Descartes, and he was a French philosopher, mathematician, physicist. Back then, people did a lot more multitasking than they do now. He devised that a pure vacuum, that really empty space, and we're talking about things that don't have cosmic rays flying through them or little spurts of helium and hydrogen atoms, empty space, in quotations, versus empty space, really empty space, that empty space cannot exist, that space is defined by matter itself. So what do we mean that space is defined by matter? What exactly did Descartes mean by this? Imagine yourself out in deep, deep intergalactic space. Imagine yourself so far removed from the universe that you can pretty much neglect anything of the universe having to do with this little scenario. Given that, we can assume that if we're not in the picture, if we ignore ourselves and just picture two balls, or two rocks, or two asteroids, two planets even, connected by some sort of mechanism, we'll say a rope, so two rocks attached by a rope out in space, out in very empty space. The second part of Newton's theory that he had outlined was that out in this deep intergalactic space, if the line between the two rocks was tight, that would mean that the rocks would have to be rotating in order to have the forces necessary to pull on the rope. This is a little bit seemingly unrelated to the bucket argument, but has to do with it in a similar context, of which, if I were to describe it, everyone would be lost, and it really wouldn't be worth it. René Descartes criticized Newton on this, saying that things that rotate tend to recede from the axis of rotation. But Newton's bucket shows that the water in the bucket remains flat as the bucket is spinning, initially at least. The shape of the water is not controlled by the bucket's spinning. Considering that the water is at rest with respect to itself, it gains centrifugal force seemingly out of nowhere. Now, in my show notes, I had to put a little star next to centrifugal, and in the physics society, this is a very common word that leaks out into society, the other one being theory, that centrifugal has this connotation of when you're spinning and you're being, quote, flung to the outside. Say you're in a car and you take a really sharp turn to the right, you're flown to the left, right? Well, not exactly. This has to do with inertial reference frames and all those things, but centrifugal force really is just a differently named thing of what it really is supposed to be. What it's supposed to be is called centripetal force, or centripetal acceleration. And as you're going around in a circular motion, you have a centripetal acceleration that's pointing inward. Centripetal means center-seeking, centrifugal means center-fleeing. Just had to star that because there's a lot of common misconceptions in use of that word, but I had to use it in that given context because it wouldn't really make sense to say that there's a centripetal acceleration. But anyway, if two rocks are in empty space and a rope is tied between them, what does it mean to say they're rotating? Now, if we're out in super, super deep intergalactic space with the universe not even being anywhere near our experiment, what exactly would the rocks be rotating with respect to? Now, ignore the sense that we're there. Just imagine the two rocks, a rope between them, and the rope is taut. If they're rotating, then what are they rotating with respect to? It's all relative, right? Quoting from the University of St. Andrews website, they say about the bucket argument, quote, when the water is not rotating with respect to absolute space, then the surface is flat. But when it spins with respect to absolute space, its surface is concave. More criticisms of Newton's experiment come from Gottfried Leibniz, who thought absolute space was absurd and that relative motion should account for the results of the experiment. Sort of a Newton-era Einstein, if you will, with relativity. George Berkeley said that the bucket went concave because it was rotating with respect to the fixed stars. Ernst Mach, the man to which we named the multiples of the speed of sound, the Mach numbers off of, said that the rotation of the bucket with respect to the water wasn't what should be compared, but the rotation of the water relative to the entire universe, all of the matter in the universe, what the universe is made of, comparing what the water is revolving to respect to the bucket, with respect to you, with respect to the Earth, with respect to the solar system, to the galaxy, and the universe and beyond. Verification of the experiment comes in 1905, where Einstein, our famous physicist of the 20th century, developed special relativity, which tended to support Newton rather than Mach, in terms of the rotating rock theory anyway. In the end, Newton was ultimately wrong, given that measurements of what's called the cosmic microwave background show that it is indeed expanding. Now, the cosmic microwave background, from inflationary cosmology, also known as the Big Bang theory, the cosmic microwave background is the last hurrah, sort of the last sort of evidence of the Big Bang before it scattered out and became super dispersed and cooled off. The cosmic microwave background permeates much of the universe, and we can see it out at super, super far distances out until just about the universe was only a few hundred thousand years old, just about there. So less than it was, even less than a million years old after the universe. We can see through the microwave background that it's expanding. Now, what does it mean for the cosmic microwave background to be expanding? Well, we know that other galaxies and other things are expanding as well. This was confirmed by a man named Edwin Hubble, who lived around Einstein's time. What he did was measure galaxies and measured what's called a redshift. We've been going over a lot of terms today, and you can listen over again to get another sense of them. But redshift is how much the galaxy is either moving towards you or away from you. If it's moving faster away from you than it is towards you, that means it has a high redshift. If it's moving towards you, it means it has a really low redshift, we'll say. Edwin Hubble noticed that a lot of these galaxies had high redshift, meaning that they were expanding away from ours. Using another sort of thought experiment, we can imagine the universe as a loaf of bread, and the galaxies would be raisins in that loaf of bread, loaf of raisin bread. Now, when you put a loaf of raisin bread in the oven, it expands due to the yeast, right? So the galaxies are all moving away from each other. That would explain why all the galaxies that we see are moving away from us. If we were to go to the Andromeda galaxy, our neighboring galaxy, we would see that our galaxy is moving away from it. Given that, knowing that the universe is expanding from that example and from Edwin Hubble's results, we can conclude that the universe should be contracting if we run time backwards. Now, we know that it'll contract and contract and contract, and it'll eventually get to a point. And this is where science and mathematics break down to the point where we come to a singularity, a mathematical improbability of infinite mass density and zero space with zero time. It's almost surreal to think of the fact that we humans, a lowly creature on this planet on an average star, have cracked this mystery of the universe. It's very humbling and also very amazing that we've come thus far in science and also logical thinking to have done so. The fact that we know that the universe has a beginning shows that Newton was ultimately wrong. Given that the universe has a beginning, given that time is not infinite for the universe, we know space and time are contiguous. They're the same sort of deal, space-time continuum. Einstein showed this with general relativity, that if you have a large mass, it'll distort space. When you have something that's moving really fast, special relativity, it distorts time. They're sort of intermingled in very interesting and very amazing ways. Given that time is not infinite, and given that space and time are directly connected to each other, space itself is not infinite. While Newton didn't exactly have the right know-how to confirm this, he was a very brilliant man for his time, very brilliant in the history of humanity himself. He was on the right track of inspiring people later on to solve those problems. And that's really what it comes down to, is inspiration. Well, that's all for this week. We hope to see you next week when our co-host Andrew returns for more witty commentary and also a little bit livelier discussion. We're still having to aim our first Skype cast, perhaps with a very special guest, a philosopher, July 1st. We might have a private recording, or we might do a Skype cast in lieu of it. But in any case, we will see you next week, and that's the end of the show.